Hey, what's good, everyone? This is Rich.
And I'm Marcus.
And you're listening to the Paychecks and Balances podcast, where we talk all things work and money with the hope we don't leave you saying, I don't remember asking you a goddamn thing.
I see you're getting tripped up over the government name still there. I heard the pause. But if you've been enjoying the podcast, tell a friend about the show. You can easily share it on Twitter by going to paychecksandbalances.com/tweet.
And if you just discovered the show, subscribe and hit us with the 5 stars on iTunes, of course, if you like what you hear.
You can tweet along to today's episode using hashtag PayBell or pound PayBell, and you can add us directly at PayBalances or email us aggressively at info@paychecksandbalances.com.
Cool. And today we're joined by a guest. Yes, you heard right. Ain't us just jive turkeying. I never understood that phrase. Where does that actually come from? Do you know?
I don't know where it comes from, but I believe our grandfathers might be able to explain that to us. I'll reach out to my father. He can probably give me a lengthy and detailed explanation.
Cool, man. And so today we're going to be talking about negotiation. And as I mentioned, we have a guest, a lawyer by trade, the man behind the American Negotiation Institute. Forget Priceline. He is the negotiator, Kwame Christian. What's going on, man?
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, no doubt, man. Super excited to have you on the show. Know you're going to drop a lot of knowledge for the people. But first, just let's talk a little bit about your background.
Yeah, for sure, man. So I'm a business lawyer. Like you said, I work with startups and small businesses. And so my first foray really into negotiation was with my undergrad degree. So I went to OSU, Ohio State, the Ohio State University, I should say, got a degree in psychology. And that's when I started becoming really interested in how people think. And then I went on to get my law degree from Ohio State again. And they actually have the top ranked dispute resolution program in the country. And went through that program and fell in love with negotiation, how to, you know, get the best deal and maintain relationships. And so after that, came here, started my own practice. Now I'm working with startups and I get to negotiate on behalf of my clients all the time. And now the most recent endeavor is starting the consulting firm, the American Negotiation Institute, and the podcast, Negotiation for Entrepreneurs. And that's just been taking off because there's a real need in the business community for this skill, because when you really think about it, it's the most valuable business skill, because it's one of the few business skills that you could actually use every day. You use it every day at work, use it every day at home. And so people are seeing value in it. So I'm just glad to be a part of delivering that value and teaching the skill.
That's what's up, man. So even going back before you got your law degree, how did you make the decision to go to law school? Was that something that you always wanted to do? Was that something that, you know, your family was like, well, we want you to be a lawyer. And so you decided that you were going to be a lawyer. What was the thinking there?
You know, that's a funny story, because so I'm first generation Caribbean American, and in my family, that's right. I love it, man. Yeah. So in my family, it was kind of understood that you're going to get a terminal degree, whatever it is, doctor, lawyer, engineer, something.
Terminal? That sounds like death.
It felt like death going through it, man. So when my decision to go to law school was really not so much because I wanted to practice law, but was because I wanted to be a politician. And so I went to law school, got the JD, and at the same time got a master's of public policy as well. And then halfway through the process, as I started to learn more about it, I was like, there's no way in hell I want to go into politics. This is awful. This is just an awful process. And so thankfully, I got into the dispute resolution program and started to learn more about negotiation. I was like, you know, I can make this lawyer thing work. And here I am.
So let me jump in a little bit, because I have danced on the fence with wolves or some other metaphor of maybe going into politics. People have told me I should go into politics. I think it's just because I use the King's English and they're like, oh, he talks good. And he should go into politics. That's probably never going to happen. But what made your decision or solidified your decision not to go into politics?
Man, it was actually a trip. It was during the Republican primary in 2012. My wife and I, she's a doctor. So we were both, she was in med school. I was in law school at the time. So we just wanted to chill. We went to Costa Rica. Phenomenal place, man. We went to the Caribbean coast, and it was like the perfect blend between Caribbean culture and the Latin American culture. And, loved it. We both speak Spanish. So we wanted to stay. And so when I was coming back, I was like, man, I probably missed so much news, probably so far behind, because at the time, since I was so into it, I was listening to like an hour of MSNBC, an hour of Fox, and an hour of NPR in the hope of trying to get some kind of balanced understanding of what's going on in the world. And so when I came back, I realized nothing changed. Everybody's still saying the same thing. And I was like, this isn't real. This is not real stuff. And that's when it hit me. I was like, this isn't what I want to spend my life doing.
Yeah, that's what's up. That's what's up.
Yeah. And so when you were thinking about going to law school, did you hear any of the like, oh, you know, lawyers have it hard these days. It's not as easy as it used to be. There's lawyers flipping burgers, because that was a lot of the sentiment a few years ago. You know, I haven't heard it as much lately, but I remember there being this wave of stories about people going to law school and then not being able to come out and immediately have opportunities available to them. So did you hear any of that stuff when you were kind of going through the process? Oh, I almost ran out of oxygen.
Yeah, I heard it, man. And a lot of my friends lived it. But the thing is, I wasn't concerned because, first of all, we all have that self-serving bias. It's the snowflake metaphor. It's like, hey, man, I'm the most unique snowflake out there. And then you land on the ground, you're just like everybody else. But for me, I knew it didn't really bother me because I was like, well, I want to be a politician. And then afterwards, when I realized like what I really wanted to do was start my own business, whatever it was, I was like, the job market really doesn't matter to me. I know I'm going to do my own thing anyway.
Yeah. And so that was another thing. You jumped straight into entrepreneurship. So I was taking a look at your LinkedIn profile because, you know, professional stalk. And at first I thought that you had done some time at a firm. Yeah, I made that sound like prison. And then I was like, oh, it looks like that's actually your own thing. I think it said the Christian firm. Is that what it was?
Yep. The Christian law office, because legally I can only name my firm after myself. So a lot of people ask me, hey, do you practice church law? I was like, no, my last name happens to be Christian. I'm a business lawyer. But yeah, man, I did do some time at a firm, and it did kind of feel that way at times. It was just a summer though. So I summered at a local law firm, a larger firm, and, realized that wasn't the way I wanted to go. I also did some time in-house with, Honda. Honda was a great place, man. A lot of fun. The atmosphere at Honda is really cool because you know how you would imagine what the plant workers wear, the all whites kind of onesie, you know, everybody.
That Breaking Bad suit,
that's right. That's right, man. But everybody wears that. So the people on the factory wear it. The lawyers wear it. The CEO wears that every day. Everybody walking around in their Honda onesie. And everybody has the same table, same kind of table, open concept. So I'm sitting here at my basic table right next to the general counsel at his basic table. Everybody just treats each other with a lot of respect because they want to try and make it seem like, because it is, we're all on the same team. I love that atmosphere, but still wasn't for me, but I loved Honda though.
So a couple of questions. First of all, was that Honda like Accord or Hyundai? Because I want to make sure I'm.
Oh no, page. Honda.
Okay, I want to get. You know, I want to plug the right company. Then, so you know, some people I think we've talked about on the show. I think we actually are inclusive of this. The hesitation to go entrepreneur. Do you have any advice or tips for somebody who's status quo? Nothing wrong with that career path or the 9-to-5 versus entrepreneur. Like, what made a difference for you to make that choice, that decision?
Yeah. So when I left law school, when I first left, I did social justice work. So I was a legal analyst at a social justice research institute. And that was really me biding my time, figuring out what's next. And it was a job that provided me with a lot of flexibility. And so I actually started the firm in September 2014 and then left that social justice job was at Ohio State. And I actually left that job in February of this year. So I was building the firm on the side for about a year and a half. And then once I got to a point where I thought it wouldn't be too much of a fiscal cliff for the family, decided to make that leap.
Oh, very nice. Very nice.
Yeah, man, that's seems to be the move for a lot of people these days, though, you know, jumping into the entrepreneurship side of things. And so when you were at Honda in your Breaking Bad suit, was there a moment where you were like, you know what, I can't do this? Or was that just always your dream and, you know, you just went and made a plan to be able to launch your own thing?
Yeah, you know, the time I realized it was actually not the Honda year. I already knew it at that point. The time I first realized it was when I was working at that big firm, you know, so I was making good money, almost like a good amount. Let me just say a good amount of money.
I was put it all out there.
Everybody's leaning in and putting their headphones against their ears like,
not going to do it. But yeah, I was making some good money. And because they pay you like a first year associate when you're in law school, having those kinds of jobs. And I was like, man, this is nice. And for the first 2 or 3 weeks, it was. And then I started to realize, like, what's the billable requirement and the billable hour requirement? And it was 1900 hours a year. Mm-hmm. And so for those of you that aren't familiar with billable hours for an attorney, you know, typical people, when you go into work, you think 9 to 5, 8 hour day. But billable hours is like time spent doing pure work. So if I'm going to the bathroom, not billing. If I'm checking email, not billing. Talking to somebody, not billing. So that came down to, if I wanted to do get 2 weeks of vacation, I would have had to bill about 7.2 hours a day. And so in order to bill that much, I would need to be in the office like 10 to 11 hours. I was like, this is not worth it. Because for me, I see a lot of value in time. You know, more so than money, I want to be in control of my time.
Right.
And so that's when I started to hatch my plan.
So how do they know? I mean, I guess, of course, you have to be honest, you know, because all lawyers are honest about everything.
Oh, you know us.
But so in terms of like the billable hours, like, are there just cameras everywhere where it's like, hey, so if you put in 8 hours, someone comes over to your desk like, well, actually, # I saw you in the I saw you walk toward the bathroom like 2 hours ago, so I need you to go back and update your time? Or is it really just the honor system and you just know that that's what you have to do?
It's really just the honor system to a certain extent. But you also, when you're billing, you also need to say like exactly what it is you do with your time too. So that kind of puts a little bit of a checks and balances. Ha ha.
I see what you did. You see that on your
timekeeping too. And they anticipate you. At most firms, I can't think of any like major big law firm that really allows you to bill regularly from home. So they'll know if you're there, you know, if you're there working those hours, they'd be able to figure it out.
Got it. Cool, man. So let's talk a little bit more about the negotiation side of things specifically. So when I was preparing for this show, I, of course, listened to a few of your podcast episodes, and you did the most thorough and probably the only episode that I've ever heard about negotiating with a car dealer. So, I mean, I listened to that and it had me wanting to walk into some lots just to see if I still got it, you know, like a married man in the club. I'm like, yo, yeah. I just want to go walk the strip, go, you know, go poly, talk about some things. You know, so what led you to put that episode together and talk about that for people?
Yeah, man, that was a lot of fun. You could probably hear the energy in my voice. I was like a kid in a candy shop, man. I love that. So I started to, I always ask my listeners, what do you want to hear? Tell me what you want to hear. Cause I could talk about stuff that I find interesting. That doesn't, you know, that won't pan out for a good show. I need to know what you want to know. And so they said, we want to hear you actually negotiate something. And I was like, well, I still have legal clients. There are some privilege issues there if I record a negotiation there. But I was like, what can I record? And I was like, oh, let's do a car negotiation. Cause everybody needs to learn. That's something that everybody's going to need to do at some point. So I was like, okay, I'm going to take you through my preparation and actually do the negotiation and record it. And since Ohio's a single party consent state, you can record something without the other person knowing and it's still legal. Mm. So important to stay on the right side of the law. So I started to do this episode, and it was just going to be one episode. I was going to do like 15 minutes of talking about preparing and then doing the actual negotiation. But I went through it with the same kind of rigid preparation strategy that I go through for a typical negotiation. And it just grew into something that was almost unrecognizable from my original idea. Mm. And so when I was done, like the way I do solo episodes is I create the blog first and then record the actual episode. The blog ended up being over 3,500 words, 9 pages, you know, because when I prep, like if I'm doing a little, like a 15 minute call, I'll do like 45 minutes of prep for that call, because when it comes down to it, when my definition of a negotiation is anytime you're in a conversation and one or more people in the conversation want something. So with that definition, we're negotiating every day of our lives. So whenever there's a negotiation, I have a very thorough preparation strategy. So as I was going through it, I just started getting more and more and more and more information. And right now, after doing all this research compared to the other blogs that are out there on how to do a car negotiation, I think at this point, it's already the most thorough resource out there, free resource out there. Mm-hmm. And that's just part one. We still have part two coming out. So part one was strategy and preparation. Part two is talking about tactics. And part three is the actual recorded negotiation.
Yeah. Yeah. See, I'm already making the mistake where I'm like, I heard part one, I'm ready to go. Like, I'm not even, yo, I want to go straight to the lot. Forget the tactics. Like, I prepped, you know? So, that's probably why some of my negotiations haven't went so well, is because I thought I had all the answers and I was too bursty about it when I probably should have taken a little bit more time. But Wim, well, I know you, or Marcus, still working on that. I know you recently copped the new whip and went through the negotiation process on your side. I know they were trying to give you those rims.
Yeah, so I would say even doing research is a first step that most people don't even take. Like, I think throughout life, most people just go, I'm going to say half sad, but you don't do a lot of research. Like, so I didn't have this information privy to me, of course. So I probably cost myself a few $1,000s, which we're probably going to talk about later here. But I did do some research. I went on the website. I knew the exact vehicle I wanted. I purposely dressed down, went to the lot, basically looking like a bum. You know, I don't know, trying to play psychological mind games, I guess. And I was like, yeah, I think I'm interested in like five cars. I really don't know what I'm looking for. I had my eye on the car that I wanted the entire time. I went around Christmas because I did some research that said the week between Christmas and the end of the year is when they're trying to clear out the lot. And so you get some of the best deals. And I knew this particular car had been on the lot for like 2 months, and they were basically dropping discounts. I could follow that online. So I knew what I wanted. I knew the package I wanted. And in this particular instance, I knew the exact car I wanted. So I went, talked to the gentleman, looked at three other cars that I was, you know, loosely interested in. You know, and then I said, okay, what about that one over there? And he's like, yeah, we've got a couple of discounts on that one. You know, it's been here on the lot for a while. But since he thought I wasn't particularly interested in it, he actually didn't spend too much time talking about it. I went away for a few days. They actually kind of messed my plan up by selling two of the other cars. So it kind of actually put me in a pinch. So I kept in negotiation, kept in talks with them. I was texting them. I was like, yeah, I think I'll stop by. I actually wanted to go on Christmas, but then my father, the king of negotiators, based on years of experience, said, do not show up to the house in a new car without giving your mom a Christmas gift first. So I had to go to the house, do the Christmas gift family thing. Then they were closed on Christmas, so I was kind of pouting a little bit because I'm a big kid. And then I went and closed the deal on, I believe, the 27th. And I now have a brand new car. Nice. One thing I would share about that that's somewhat of the negotiation that I'm glad I didn't crack under, and Richard's familiar with this. They tried to get me to do the dealership financing plan. And I think it was, based on some of the other moves that I've made, it was a good APR. I think it was 3-4% that they were offering. And I was like, I think I can beat that. And I had nothing to go off of. I mean, here goes back to the not prepping for that particular part of the conversation. And I'm like, I'm pretty sure I can beat that. I remember reading online somewhere that the local credit union actually was offering 1.45% for if you qualify, which I later found out was folks with credit scores of 730 and above. Mm-hmm. And so I'm sitting there, I had nothing to go on. I had basically no negotiating strength, but because I wasn't pressured to make the deal right now, I was prepared to walk away. And I think that's actually the biggest, I hate to say Trump card because of all the things going on right now, but normally I would say Trump card, is I can walk away from this negotiation. So my strongest argument is that I can leave this table. So I actually was prepared to walk away. We signed and maybe Kwame, you could talk about this. We signed an agreement, which I was even unfamiliar with that existed, where I wasn't purchasing the vehicle. I agreed to purchase the vehicle when I secured financing. And which made me really nervous, but I wanted the car, so I drove off the lot with it. And I went over to the credit union, and it took a week because of all the holidays and all the difficulties we were going through, but I was able to secure that percentage rate. I got a 1.45% offer. I ultimately went with 1.95 for a longer term. And I went back to the dealership and I crunched the math later on. Rich knows I love to do this. And just by waiting that 5-day period, not rushing that decision, I saved myself thousands, like I think it was like $3,000 in interest before wow. I ever drove off the lot, just by saying I'm going to get the best financing deal I can get.
Well, oh, wow. So I thought you said that you drove the new car off the lot and then drove it to get financing. I was like, wait, they let you do that?
Yeah, I think it's a buyer's agreement, and someone might be able to speak to the technical form, but I basically signed an agreement that said I would either finance through the dealership or secure independent financing. And I was able to, I didn't know it existed, but I was able to leave with the vehicle. I guess it's a purchase agreement. And I had I think they gave me 7 days or something to that effect to secure financing. But yes, I'm really, even now, proud that I made that decision. Really stick it to your guns. Like I said, I wanted a new car, but I didn't need a new car. So I told them, I was like, look, I'm prepared to walk away, you know, whatever. Yeah. I think I can do better than this percentage rate that you're offering me. And then they kind of did, you know, their dealership, their sales, I get it. But they did the peer pressure thing. Oh, this is the best percentage rate. And we've got 27 dealerships. I can show you the computer screen. Look, these are all these financing deals that we mark up on our side because I know that percentage rate is lower. Plus, I have to make a profit on it. I didn't say that out loud, but I'm like, okay, that's nice. But I think I could beat that. And I'm prepared to leave if you don't, if we disagree, we can't reach an agreement, that's fine. And then they, like I said, they pull out, she reached in her cabinet, thumbed through some forms that I didn't know existed and pulled out that purchaser's agreement. At least that's what I'm going to call it.
Wow, man. Yeah, I didn't even know that was an option. So Kwame, any critiques on Marcus's approach to negotiating or anything you'd want to add on that?
It was pretty solid, man. There are a couple of nuggets that I want to tease out there. And this is stuff that I didn't know before yesterday, before I recorded the part two of when it comes to tactics. Mm-hmm. So dealerships make money on you in two ways. You know, the overall price of the car and everything that goes along with that and financing. So a lot of times, even if you, let's say you hypothetically, you're able to negotiate $5,000 off a car, which would be a huge success. If you are not careful when it comes to the details, when it comes to financing, they can make $6,000 off of you in financing, and they would make more than the total of the original total of the car. And so the negotiation doesn't just end when you talk about the total price. Like Marcus was talking about, you need to really be wary on the financing side because that's money you could possibly be throwing away if you're not paying attention.
Yo, I really want to get back to this dealership, man. I definitely let them press the button. Like, sure, let's see what options we have. Click, click, click. And then it's like, yeah, we've got this financing and this financing, not even thinking about, you know, what I could have done outside of that. But I'm gonna let you cook since I cut you off.
Oh, no, it's all good, man. And that's the thing, because, we always focus on the big numbers. I mean, that's what the sexy number is. It's like, man, I saved a big chunk of money. You don't want to talk about the little chunks of money that people are extracting from you. You know, they're like mosquitoes. They just keep coming back for just a little bit more. But you don't pay attention because it doesn't hurt that much at the time. And then talking about the peer pressure you mentioned, Marcus, in any negotiation, one of the key defensive tactics is differentiating between information and influence. So if you give me information, which is something that can be backed up by objective fact, then I will allow myself to change the way I think based on that. However, if you're just giving me something to influence me, I'm not going to change my position on that. So what's an example? So if the dealership can say, we added floor mats that came to us at a cost of $300. That's why it's $300 above market. Okay, cool. I got it. That makes sense. And I can verify that. But if you're talking about how great this deal is, how it's a limited time sale, blah, 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 that's just noise. Ignore that. They're just saying that to influence you to change your position.
Yeah, I'm definitely scribbling notes like that meme with the kid with the glasses and the notebook, which looks like he's in high school. So yeah. Go ahead, Marcus.
And I couldn't let this go. So I was over here crunching the numbers. I believe they offered a rate of about 5%. So yeah, it's about 3,000 in savings just before you even walk out the door. So I like to, the reason I crunch numbers, besides the fact that I'm an auditor, is that's what people hold on to. They're like, oh yeah, you negotiated a deal, 1%, 5%. That doesn't sound like a lot of dollars. But when you're talking about tens of thousands over a 5-year period, like, those percentage points add up very quickly. I think that's what Kwame was trying to hit on. So it was about, I don't have the exact number here. I think it's like 3,200, but you knew I wasn't going to drop that.
Yeah. And for those of you who aren't auditors, there are a lot of free tools online that can help you crunch those numbers too.
Yeah. Yeah. I know we've talked about a few of them.
Yeah. I want to point out the one I used right here, and I actually use it a lot, is an Excel loan amortization schedule. It's available. It's free. It's actually one of their basic templates. So I have 2013, but if you have the most updated Office, you have access to a lot of tools. Excel is, it's okay on what they give away for free, but I actually use this one a lot. So loan amortization schedule.
Yeah. And I know they have a lot of templates now in Google Docs too, that people don't even check to, see about, you know, and I've used a couple of them, not so much for like the debt and finance type of stuff, but just for like other things. So I would encourage people to look inside their Google Docs and see what type of templates are there. But let's go a little bit broader in terms of talking about negotiation. Definitely gonna drop back in the checkout part two on the in the car negotiation series. It sounds like you got like a little mini series going on, keeping people captivated with that.
Yeah.
But in terms of negotiation generally, what are some of the common mistakes you think that people make?
I think the biggest mistake people make in negotiation is believing that you make the most strides in negotiation by talking. And that's not the case. So in my negotiations, my goal is to keep the breakdown of communication about 70-30. So I'm talking 30% of the time and they're talking 70% of the time. And so why is that? So here's the thought question I typically ask when I'm giving negotiation seminars, and I'll ask it to ask you guys. So if you had an option, you had to choose between having your hand on the steering wheel or your foot on the gas and brake pedal, which would you choose?
Ooh,
I think gas pedal and brake.
Okay. And why?
I think it's more control.
Okay. All right. And what do you think, Rich?
I'm going to say steering wheel because I can at least steer the car toward something that's not going to cause airbags to hit my face.
Right. And that's the exact same reason I choose steering wheel too, because when your foot is on the gas or brake pedal, you can determine the speed, but I control where we go. So I can avoid crashes and take you where my ultimate destination is. How fast or slow we go, that's up to you. And so, how do we implement control in a conversation? People think it's by talking, but it's by asking questions, and it's by asking open-ended questions. So I ask these questions and I know where I want them to go, and I'm leading them down the logical path that I want them to go. And hold on one second, Rich, you had the advantage because you listen to my last podcast, and I gave this exact example. So you knew the right answer.
I mean, I still would have said that anyway, though. I just want to point that out. You know, okay. I wasn't fronting for it.
That's what we do it. Wow.
You see that, Marcus? He acts like he has your back. And this is
I do have his back.
See, I see the negotiation tactic that he used right there was withholding key information. But that's cool.
That's right. Cool.
I'm just saying, you know, I would have went, I'm very much a steering wheel type of guy. So, hey, you know, that's what I would have said anyway. Just putting that out there. No shade.
Hey, man, you see what I'm driving. So, you know, why I went with the gas. So.
Fair point.
So what are you driving? We can't just leave it there. What are you driving now?
I'm driving a Dodge Charger now. That's the car I was negotiating to get. Nice. Which apparently makes me unmarriable, according to Twitter. There's been several tweets about this topic. And,
wow.
I apparently solidified myself in the unmarriable camp, combined with the fact that I'm a Scorpio and I drive a Charger. So there's a hashtag forever alone for me. That's cool. You know? that's the lane that I've chosen for myself, keeping with the metaphor.
Forever alone.
Oh, man.
That's funny. So how about situations for people to negotiate that they don't normally think about? You know, because you said earlier on that there are opportunities to negotiate every day, but are there common situations for negotiation that you think people miss?
Yeah, I guess the big obvious one is salary negotiation. But you had an episode on that recently. I don't know how deeply you want me to dive into that one.
We can talk about that. I mean, you're the negotiation guru, the negotiation base god. So I definitely want to talk about that a bit.
Okay, cool. So negotiating your salary, when you really think about it, it's one of the few times, maybe the only time in your life, where you get to work at an hourly rate of thousands of dollars per hour. Did you ever think about it that way?
Thousands of dollars per hour. Nah, yes. I hadn't. Tell me more.
So think about it. So if we were, let's say we have a $50,000 offer on the table. Mm-hmm. And we're like, hey, thank you, sir. I'll take that $50,000. But now let's say we go ahead and negotiate a little bit. You know, I take the time and I do some research, do a half hour of prep, half hour negotiation. That's 1 hour. And so I say, hey, you know, I'd like some more. And I conduct a solid negotiation and I only get 10% more. So now instead of starting at $50,000 a year, I'm starting at $55,000 a year. That mm-hmm. hour I gain in that hour of time I spent, I gained $5,000 a year. So these negotiations that we just kind of let go by the wayside, these are potentially the most valuable times of our lives, like the most valuable conversations we're ever going to have. And some people just don't take the opportunity to get that money.
Yeah. So, and I've read different stats about how much money people cost themselves over time by not negotiating that first salary. Have you seen anything on that, or have you given any thought to how much that turns out to be over the course of 10, 15 years that someone could cost themselves by not negotiating their salary?
For sure. And here's a little view into how negotiation creeps into every part of my life. So I knew that I had this interview coming up at 11. And so from 9:30 to 10:59, I was prepping. Mm. So I have those numbers for you. So here's an example. So let's say we start at age, there are two people. Let's say their names are, I don't know, Marcus and Wim. And so they start at age 22, both equally qualified. And they receive job offers at $25,000. Not much, but it's something. Congrats on your job.
It actually sounds like Marcus's first job out of school.
Really?
Actually, I made $19,000, but I appreciate that painful reminder there, Rich.
My bad, bro.
Always there with the painful reminder.
See this guy, man. I don't know about this rich guy. I don't know about him.
I wear shades.
But let's say Marcus negotiates $5,000 more. So Marcus starts off at 25,000. So Marcus starts off at 30,000. Rich, you're still at 25. And so let's say you never negotiate again. So if each of you receives 3% raises every year throughout your careers, by the time you're 60 on an annual basis, Marcus, you'd be making more than $15,000 a year more than Rich. And then your extra earnings over 38 years would be.
I like this scenario already now.
That's right, man. Oh, you just wait. It gets better. So over the course of that time, over 38 years, you would earn over $350,000 more than Rich.
Which is insane.
Yeah. And then imagine if you took the time to invest that some of that money, you know? And so what are the ramifications of that? Yeah. It's going to be over $500,000 more, you know, when you think about the possibilities of investment, but let's take it a step further. What does that practically mean for your family? I mean, that is the wealth gap right there. You know, your children are going to be starting off on completely different playing fields.
Yeah.
Just because you took the time to negotiate one time. But in reality, the differences in careers are going to probably be significantly more because, Marcus, you're not just going to negotiate once. You're going to be negotiating throughout your career. So by the time it's all said and done, it's equally qualified, but you're going to be making millions of dollars more over the course of your lifetime just because you chose to negotiate.
Which is crazy because people are going to – so if no one – so let's say – someone doesn't listen to this podcast and go, oh, I should be negotiating. That person is probably going to continue to make the same mistakes over and over again and keep shortchanging themselves every time they have an opportunity to ask for more, which just creates even more of a disparity.
Yeah, I was going to bring it home. I mean, while we were walking through that scenario, I realized I had to do it in my head because I don't have my resume in front of me, but at least three jobs. And I think the age was 27 before I ever negotiated. So that $19,000 job, I didn't negotiate. I was happy to have a job. And then I took two more jobs after that in which I didn't negotiate my salary. And yeah. I think I was, it was my third, actually it would have been my fourth. So my fourth actual job before I finally said, I'm going to negotiate my rate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I've definitely made some of those mistakes earlier on in my career. So I think even when I was going from working, this was just a few years ago, where I was going from working at a nonprofit to working at a tech startup company. And, you know, when you work at a nonprofit, nonprofits typically don't pay as much. And, you know, it's not like you're getting like 10% merit increases every year or anything like that. And so I was there for about 3 years, and that's basically 3 years that I hadn't kept up with what was really going on in the market. And so when I got this offer from this tech startup, and they're like, what type of salary are you looking for and all of that? And I'm like, oh, you know, something in this ballpark would be cool. And they're like, great, done. And then I'm like, oh, man, like, that's awesome. I got exactly what I asked for. You know, I'm like, you know, and here's the thing. It was a huge increase from where I was at the nonprofit. But again, I was working in a sector that doesn't traditionally pay as much. You know, I hadn't really kept up with what my peers who were doing similar work were doing. And I thought that I knew exactly what I wanted. And at the time I was happy, but let's just say I came across some information. I'm not going to say how I came across information of the person who was in this role before me. And I saw that they were making like $25,000 more, having had the same experience and having done the same job. And I'm pretty confident that I did that job more effectively than they did based on the mess that I picked up when I got there. So, you know, it felt like I had negotiated, like I asked for what I wanted and I got it. But looking back, I probably could have done so much better in that situation. And I heard you making some sound effects in the background, like shaking your head and waving your fist at me.
I was hoping that wasn't audible, but yeah, it's, you know, it's tough. It's whenever somebody accepts your offer right away, you should be concerned. You made a mistake in most situations. Here's one rule of thumb. Something people always ask is, when should I make the first offer, or who should make the first offer? And there's never a situation where it's like, oh, you should always make the first offer or vice versa. But this is the rule of thumb. Whoever has the most information should make the first offer. So in that situation, you were coming from a different job, different sector. You don't know the company's numbers. So it would be very inappropriate for you to make the first offer. But you did, and they snagged you up. And so if I don't know what numbers we're talking about here, but if you would have waited and said, well, you know, I'm more interested in seeing what you have to offer, dodging that initial question, and then hearing what they said, they would have probably started off probably $10,000 to $15,000 higher than what you would have originally offered.
You know,
and then
what?
It would have just been a different starting point.
You know what? And there's something crucial in this. So a lot of times when people apply for jobs online, there's that question, what's your current salary or what's your salary expectation? And
yeah,
it's almost like forcing people into making the first offer.
It is. That's exactly what it's doing, because it changes the reference point for the beginning of the negotiation. And it's essentially like an anchor. So you're anchoring yourself. So whenever you have that question, always write NA. Always. It's because it's not applicable.
Now, what if there's a drop down? Because this is kind of what happened with this job, too, that I was talking about. There's a drop down and they don't give you an NA. They're like, you're in this range, this bucket or this bucket. And so sometimes people get a little nervous because they're like, well, I don't want to price myself out of the job, so I'm going to pick this lower window.
You know? Right.
So how do you handle that type of situation?
That's, you know, that's tough. When if it's an application where it's just all online and it has that little red asterisk that's forcing you to answer the question, that's tough. I would call. It's so important. Mm-hmm. This is so important that I would just say, hey, I'm calling, or give a hard copy application. Do whatever you can to avoid answering that question, because it puts you in a position where it's like, I have two choices here. Either I hurt my negotiation strategy here, or I lie. And lying, never want to lie in negotiation. Never, ever, 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 ever want to do that, because one of the most persuasive things you have is your credibility. And once you lose that, it's going to be hard to create a relationship after that.
So you wouldn't pick the, you know, because I'm thinking some people may, if they don't take the approach of I'm scared I might price myself out, the other side of that would be to pick a, even higher compensation range, you know, thinking that when it comes time for negotiation, that's where they'll start. And even if it's not currently where you're at, you could say that, oh, the question asked for my current, but this is my expectation. So it's kind of like,
I like that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like on that border of truthfulness, like where it's like, hey, like you forced me to make a decision. So I had to make a decision and now we're going to talk about it.
Yeah, I like that. Like if there's a comment section, you could say, referring to question number 13, you asked me to shoot myself in the foot, but I decided not to instead. And the thing is too, oh, go ahead, Marcus.
I was just going to say I elected to pass.
Yeah, that's not my cup of tea. You know, it's one of the things too, people are afraid of negotiating because they're afraid they'll look greedy or they'll turn people off or anything. That's not the case. That can never happen in a negotiation unless you negotiate poorly. Mm. You know, that's it, and you need to treat everybody with respect. And as long as both parties feel respected, they're actually going to respect you more if you take the time to fight for yourself. Because if I don't even see you fighting for yourself in this interview process, how are you going to fight for my business once you're on the team?
Yeah, I think we did talk about that before where if someone and I've actually seen this, in places that I've worked, I won't say where because it might be too specific, but where somebody had accepted an offer and then I think they tried to come back and renegotiate after they had accepted and ask for more because they got what they want too quickly, kind of like me when I made that bad decision a few years ago. And the company ended up rescinding the offer because they were like, you know, this person, how are they going to negotiate for us? Like, are they going to throw their ethics to the side? Like, this person already agreed to accept the offer, and now they're trying to come back and renegotiate details, and it's becoming more of a headache than we wanted, you know? So that salary negotiation in itself says a lot about how you're going to handle business situations.
Exactly. Yeah, just consider it part of the interview.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're showcasing more skills.
So I do have a brief story. I think, Rich, I'm going to assume you put the cursor there to trigger this story. And I have literally never.
If you're like me, you probably hate grocery shopping. And if you're like me, you probably hate figuring out dinner every night. And that's where HelloFresh comes into play. So HelloFresh is the meal kit delivery service that makes cooking fun, easy, and convenient. Each week, HelloFresh creates new recipes with step-by-step instructions designed to take around 30 minutes for everyone from novice chefs like myself to seasoned home cooks. And one of the best things about this is if you're cooking just for yourself, each meal could last you 2 days. I discovered that when I was making this sizzling beef stir fry last week. I promise you, it really was sizzling. And if you're wondering how the food gets delivered, it arrives at your doorstep in a special insulated box for free. So for $35 off your first week of deliveries, visit HelloFresh.com and enter paychecks. Again, visit HelloFresh.com and enter paychecks when you subscribe. Check it out.
Told this anyway, I would have honestly taken it to my grave, but I feel, you know, I'm opening up for the listeners. People know that I'm speaking from the heart. This is some advice I got from a trusted mentor in leadership training. And my negotiation, I won't say where, I realize it was pretty specific in the notes, was actually completely based on the movie Soul Food. Yeah. From 1997, I had to look it up on IMDb just to figure out like when this movie came out, and it clearly made an impression on me. So Soul Food with Mekhi Phifer and Mel Jackson, most people don't even know. I had to like look up what his name was, but he seems to just play light skinned nemesis in every Soul Food related like movie. Like that literally seems to be his archetype. So hopefully you now know who Mel Jackson is, and if not, Google him. But there was a scene between Mekhi Phifer and Mel Jackson, for those of you who remember the movie, where it was right before Mekhi Phifer punched him in his face, actually, which tells you a lot about why I took away from this scene. And Mr. Mel Jackson says a salary amount. I won't say it, but if you know the salary amount that he said, it's probably on YouTube somewhere. That's the amount of money I asked for. I was like, man, that was really cool how he said that in that movie. The next time I get an opportunity to ask for a job, that's the amount of money I'm going to ask for. But not knowing, flash forward to 2016, that I was poorly negotiating and I didn't have any information, they jumped on that number. They were so excited. Like I was, and to this day, I toss and turn at night. Sometimes I wake up like, did I undersell? Why did they accept it so fast? They actually came back with a higher number. I'm like,
oh no.
How much money did I cost myself? Like I and I'll never know. But that was my complete quote unquote negotiation was based on the 1997 movie Soul Food. For those of you who hadn't seen it, I have a description. One person can keep a family together. And when that one person is gone, a family can be torn apart. Soul Food. So, yes, that was the story of my first, I should say, wasn't my last negotiation based on the movie Soul Food.
That's pretty crazy.
Well, two thoughts. First thought is it is probably best that you never find out that number, that just for your mental health. And the second thing is, now I think I might, one of my next episodes might be how to negotiate like Mel Jackson. So keep your eye out for that. Drop in 2016.
Have you seen this movie? Have you seen Soul Food? I can't even remember the movie's any good, but I remember that scene. It's probably on YouTube. I should look it up. I might drop in the show notes. It's telling.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. That's
dramatic ellipsis.
That's crazy that's how you, it makes me wonder the other numbers that people have thrown out there just based off of things that they've seen on TV or even worse, heard in a song.
$1 million.
I know. Be like, oh, so you look, I'm looking for a milli. Like, I'm just imagining someone going into an interview and trying that, and the person sitting on the other side of the table, like, yeah, this isn't gonna work so well. So, how about when it comes to negotiating pay increases? Because that's a little bit different situation because you already have an established relationship, and now you're going in to have a conversation with a manager, with you know, your manager's manager, HR, about wanting more money or wanting more responsibility, whatever it is. So how would you go about approaching that type of situation?
Yeah, that's tricky because it's not as clear as like, oh, hey, I got an offer, time to negotiate. So really, you want to start the negotiation about a year before you really want to ask for it. And so the way that people typically think about a negotiation is like me sitting at a table talking to somebody else, blah, 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 blah. But the thing is, there's no beginning and end to a negotiation because it's all about the relationship. So after let's say you start at a job and you're about 6 months in, things are going well. You could come and have a conversation with your manager and say, listen, I know it's early. I'm not trying to ask for a pay increase now, but I want to talk about my future at this company. And so you have that conversation with them and you say, what do you see the next step being for me? In your opinion, what's the next step for me? Okay, it's this position. Well, what kind of pay increase can I anticipate with that? And you kind of pre-negotiate the offer. And so the next position, so it's like, if I accomplish X, Y, Z, I will get this. So now it becomes more of an equation. So now it's not really when do I have this conversation? Now the situation has shifted to once I accomplish X, Y, Z, I will get this.
That's a good approach to it. I'm also thinking, because there are some places that try to be real coy about salary information. They're like, oh, you know, we can't guarantee you anything. It could be somewhere between 2% and 20%. And they just give you like some big range of where it mm-hmm. could be. So are there any tactics that people can use when a company is trying to be coy about information? Or is it just, you know, if that's how the company is, let it be. Otherwise, you might turn the negotiation in a more negative direction.
What I would do is one of the most powerful things you can do. One of the, I think, five sources of powers in negotiation is having alternatives. And so even if you fully intend to stay at an organization, keep your eyes open, field offers. And so then when you come back to the table and they say, you know, we talked about before the range could be between 2 and 22%. And then you're like, okay, well, you know, really it just comes down to numbers for me. If you're going at the 2%, well, I have another company who's interested and they're talking about a 10% increase from where I am now. Mm. What can we do? And then you ask the open-ended question. And it's like, what can we do to make sure that I stay? And then we just take it from there.
Yeah, that's a very scary situation for some people, though, because and you'll read varying articles about this, talking about, you know, never bring an outside offer back to your current company to negotiate, because then it automatically makes you expendable because now they think you're looking, so they're going to end up cutting you anyway. So do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, it's tough, you really need to know who you're negotiating with. or I should say with whom you are negotiating. So one of the key things that I think is incredibly important when it comes to preparation is knowing who you're talking to. So for me, my rule of thumb is I want to get as much information on them as I would if I was trying to date them. So I know everything about them. So LinkedIn, social media, all that stuff. And if you know that your company values loyalty and everything, and they might be offended by you bringing in an outside offer, you need to change your tactics a little bit. Maybe the conversation isn't, hey, I've been looking and I found. Maybe you started off by, I have been approached by somebody with this offer. I wasn't looking, but now it has me thinking about where I am in my career and where I want to go.
Yeah. So it's almost like that slight change of wording kind of brings it back. So versus I've been looking around out there because I want to bring something back to negotiate higher versus, hey, yeah, this opportunity happened to come my way. Sounded pretty good to me, but I like being here. What do we do about this?
Exactly. But you see how subtle that is. You know, it's that's why it's so important to pre-think as much of the negotiation as possible, because coming up with that kind of subtlety off the fly is incredibly difficult. So you want to know what you're going to say beforehand. And that's why prep is so important.
Right. So a lot of negotiation deals with money automatically, but let's briefly talk a little bit about, you know, situations where people may be negotiating with creditors, with institutions who are coming after them for money, or you're trying to go to an institution to get money. And I know, Wim, you talk about this a little bit in your book, but you had a story where, you know, you were kind of at, I was going to say wit's end, but that's probably not the right colloquialism or cliche phrase. Yeah. Where, you know,
that's accurate. I mean, I called it rock bottom was my quote. So whatever metaphor works. So hashtag plug, the book would be out in September 2016. I was negotiating at that age, probably about 25, with the absence of information, with a client who literally had all of the information. So I was trying to obtain a consolidation loan at a point where it had gotten so bad with my credit cards that I couldn't even pay the minimum. So I needed this consolidation loan so badly that if I didn't get it, I actually didn't have a plan B. It was plan A and only plan A. And it had gotten to a point where, I mean, I was on the cusp of, I mean, I didn't entertain it or visit with a lawyer or anything to that effect, but I really think I was nearing bankruptcy. Like I was reaching a point where I would have been unable to pay my bills month to month. So I would have just started bleeding into the red every month thereafter if I didn't get this loan. And the lender at this particular institution, they had my credit report. They knew how much I was paying month to month. They had my credit score. They knew what I owed now. They knew what I had outstanding. And I had none of that information. So everything they told me, I had to take at face value. They said, you're paying, I think at that time, a few hundred dollars, if not thousands, maybe a month in credit payments. Okay. It looks like your credit score is XYZ. If you say so. And I'm looking on your credit report and it looks like you have 6 revolving accounts. Is that accurate? Sure. I had no negotiating power. And as I talk about in the book and I've shared on the show, it was and continues to be the worst one of now. But at that time, it was the worst feeling I'd ever had in my life. I mean, I think people, regardless of scenario, can relate to a situation where you were negotiating, debating or arguing and the other person has all the information, not only all the facts, but the information you would need to even negotiate, argue or debate. And yeah, I as I declared in the book, I plan to never put myself in that situation again.
Now, what's interesting is everything you did is basically what Kwame said earlier to not do.
Yeah. The ironic part of that entire story is I called them. Like I called them with no information. So I started the negotiation with no information, which is now looking back, such an insane activity. And I was younger. I mean, I was an auditor, but I must not have been a very good one at that time because I was not prepared. And I think that also, I actually do want to talk on that a little bit. I was an auditor at that time. I was, you know, been in the field for about 3 years, but I think people are like, I'm an auditor and I'm a lawyer. I'm a business professional. So you get this haughty sense of yourself that, you know, I'm too good to do research. I'm too good to talk to an expert. I'm too good to get the facts that I need to have this negotiation with the car dealership. I told somebody that I went to the post office once, you know, with my graduate, or excuse me, my bachelor's degree and my business administration, my auditor background. And I've never felt more dumb in my entire life. And I was just trying to mail a box. So the person who does that day to day is the expert. And like, if you humble yourself enough to recognize where your expertise ends, like I felt like that has been, I have made far more strides in my life when recognizing and humbling myself to go, you know what? I know a lot about this. I know nothing about that. Whom do I talk to that knows a lot about that, that can help me be successful in that situation? And I think a lot of people struggle to recognize, whatever the profession is, I'm a doctor. And you can be very smart and intelligent in a field, area, or profession, and still know nothing about another field, area, or profession. I think that's hard for people to recognize. I think that's also why it's so hard for people to have these negotiations to get the information they need to be successful in the car dealership negotiation or to negotiate their credit scores, because you want to assume that you know everything because you're smart.
Right.
You got a degree. You got a piece of paper. You got a job. You work a 9-to-5. You raise kids, whatever it is. That doesn't make you an expert. And if you can recognize that it's continuous learning. Another individual told me recently that some people, they get a degree and they think that they're done learning at 4 years. And I hire people that are willing to learn for 40 years.
Mm. That's a pretty wisdom filled statement.
Yeah, I stole it, but I appreciate it.
So, Kwame, I imagine at first when he was telling the story, you were probably turning as well. You probably can't turn red, you know, because I can't turn red.
I try hard, but it never happens.
But hearing all of that, is there anything that you'd want to underscore or anything that came to mind in terms of some of the mistakes that Wim may have made or even some of the key insights that he was able to pull from those past mistakes?
Yeah, for sure. I think the big one is, obviously, and you covered this, is getting as much information as possible. And there are two times when you can get information. You want to take as much time as possible before the negotiation to get information. But really, one of the, and this is one of the best ways to alleviate pressure, because there's a lot of times when negotiation can be a stressful endeavor for people. And so if you kind of change in your mind, like, oh, this isn't a negotiation, this is an information session, my goal is to get as much information as possible, that little shift in mindset will make you a better negotiator, because you'll come in knowing what questions you want to ask and you'll be getting as much information as possible. And so during the conversation, you're going to be shifting those power dynamics, because like you said, Marcus, you felt pretty powerless because they had all of the information and they were asking you questions and you were confirming the facts for them. But think about how it would have changed if you had a set of questions, like a list of open-ended questions that you were going to ask. They would have been responding to you, and that entire conversation would have been spent with them giving you information and you kind of leveling the playing field when it comes to those power dynamics with regard to knowledge and the information asymmetry that existed.
Kwame, you said something earlier in the show, and you actually said it off the cuff because I think it's occurred so naturally to you now, but I think it was really important and I want to point out, is someone told me, as far as presentations and training, prep twice as long as the training. So I was going into a 1 week training. He's like, I'm going to prep for a month. And you said you had a 15 minute phone call coming up and you've prepped 45 minutes for it. And I think that's, people don't do that. Like, if you know, a 5 minute conversation, prep 10 minutes, you know, 15 minute conversation, prep 30, like double whatever the length of the conversation and prep time is going to be.
Right. I mean, think about it. How much time do you think Usain Bolt trains for a 9 second race?
That's a pretty good point.
Here's why I'm laughing. I know why you went with Usain Bolt. Shout out to the Caribbean, but I was writing down Batman prep time.
What?
No, because you know all the arguments online about how Batman can win any battle with prep time. I was like, yo, channel your inner Batman. Prep time.
That's right, man. That's right. The thing is, it's when people think about negotiation, they think about the quick back and forth, the quick wits that are at play. But really, the negotiation is won at the time that's most boring, before it happens. You know, here's an example to speak to what you said, Marcus, about having humility. It's not very difficult for me. I'm in my office right now. For me to get up, walk out, people will be like, that's pretty simple. You pick up your bag, you leave. But I make mistakes doing that all the time. And because of that, I have a checklist that I go through every day, same exact checklist. And sometimes I'm like, man, Kwame, you're a lawyer, 3 degrees. You got this. Walk out this door and don't look at that list. But I inevitably forget something multiple times a week. That's pretty simple. And so for me, when I'm prepping for a negotiation, I have a set of questions that I go through, like a one page prep sheet. And so before every negotiation, I have at least 1 to 2 pages of information, notes and questions. So I'm ready to go. You know, so never discount the difficulty or undermine the prep. You know, no matter how simple it is, take that time to make sure you're as prepared as possible.
Well, now I have 2 comments. First of all, Rich, I want to advise for undermine the prep. I thought that could be at least a hashtag, if not the title of the show. So I'm going to advocate for that. And then, yeah, again, it's funny because I think people, they hear that I'm an auditor and they're like, oh, man, first of all, they think I work at the IRS and I crunch taxes all day, which I go. That's a good example. I go to H&R Block to do my taxes. Like, I go to the people that know what they're doing. They've been doing it for the last 5 years, have done a great job and gotten me a lot of money. But the simple things is, it's funny what I don't know. And here's the part where I think I hopefully will change somebody's life. So I got this new building. We have 700 people in this building. I actually think it's 744. Parking lot, you know, it's wide open. And I worked there for months, like about 2 months every day, because I come in to work. I'm not a morning person. I'm in zombie mode. I'm drinking my coffee. I don't remember anything. I think I sleepwalk and drive-walk to work, or drive-drive and sleepwalk to work. So in the afternoon, by the final, you know, finally under the cover of light, I come out and I could never remember where my car was. I'm searching the parking lot like an idiot. And I'm like, Mark, you can fix this. There has to be a way to resolve this. Like, you are smarter than this parking lot. Now I park at this post lamp every time. Like, I park at the same light lamp post. As far as, you know, I get a little walk in. I get my little speedboat, or what's it called? Fit band steps in each day. But everybody knows, even other people know where my car is at this point. But it is the simple things, your checklist, where my car is parked, that actually makes the bigger things easier to solve.
Definitely, man. And I try to spend a lot of time on prep with the podcast, with everything, for a lot of the reasons that we're talking about here, even though I've still went in and poorly negotiated, even after prepping. I remember going back to the car thing. I'm looking across websites. I'm like, okay, the car is this much here. The car is that much there. Okay, fair enough. I'm ready to go, you know, and
and took the first offer they gave you.
I'm like, I want this. Great. You know, and that's, and it feels like someone can feel like they really did prep, but then look back and it's like, there's so much other information that I could have obtained. And Kwame, I know when people go over and listen to the series on car negotiation, like, you covered a whole lot of things, as it relates to questions. So even like looking through Yelp reviews to figure out who's the person you should go work with at the dealership, you know, and, or asking for the most experienced or most seasoned salesperson. There's just little stuff that I hadn't thought about before, but we are nearing the end of our time together. Kwame, any last thoughts for this episode? Cause we're definitely going to have you back on again. Any other thoughts for this episode as we close out, as it relates to negotiation or things that you really want people to keep in mind?
Yeah, for sure. There are 2 things. So first thing, the one thing that you all could do right now, you and your audience could do right now to become a better negotiator in your everyday life. Because remember, it's not just negotiating at work and, you know, with your managers and your employees, but it's also when you come home, you have negotiations. And honestly, it's the people that we're closest to are the people that we are negotiating with the most. And so the best thing you can do to improve your negotiation skills is focusing on asking high-level, thoughtful, open-ended questions, because open-ended questions force the other person to elaborate and gets them talking. So that has the benefit of controlling the conversation and giving you information. And then the second thing, I'd like to give out some freebies to the audience.
Oh, wait, hold on. There we go.
There it is. Yeah. So the first freebie is, a lot of times people don't negotiate because they don't know what is negotiable. So I have a list of things in your personal life, and if you're an entrepreneur in your business life, that you can negotiate. So if you go to AmericanNegotiationInstitute.com/list, LIST, you can get a list of all of the things that are negotiable in your business life and personal life.
Dope.
And then for people who are buying a car, I have that like a negotiation prep sheet specifically for car negotiations. So again, same website, but /car. So C-A-R for the Sesame Street listeners out there and list. So those are the two freebies I have up.
There it is, man. You know, as you see, I'm working all of these in throughout the show, and you gave me an opportunity to introduce that one. So I appreciate that, good brother.
My pleasure.
Yeah, man.
I know you talked about the website before we wrap up here. Is there any other social medias that you want to plug?
Yeah, so LinkedIn is a great place to reach me. Always active on LinkedIn. So I post my episodes on LinkedIn and the blogs on LinkedIn too. So if you connect with me on LinkedIn, Kwame Christian, K-W-A-M-E, spelled like Kwame, pronounced like Kwame. And
I know exactly who you said that for too. I know exactly who you made that clarification for.
But yeah, so Kwame Christian on LinkedIn. And I started Snapchatting too. So I was telling you all earlier, I use that as my productivity diary. It keeps me accountable. So I'm typically now, as of this week, the latest I got into my office was 6:30 a.m. So yeah. Typically I'm in before 5, just putting in that work, trying to get where you guys are.
Now time cool. out. I have to ask. You said you work for yourself. Now, when you say the office, are you like waking up and walking down the hallway?
I used to, but now I have a 10-month-old. And so I had to retreat, man. My son is beating me. He took my territory, and I had to get an office space so I can actually be productive.
I was just making sure that was like a hashtag humble brag. Like, yeah, I was in the office at 5:30, and then your office is like a studio apartment. You just turn around and you're in your office. I just wanted to clarify for the listeners.
No, to that point, though, I remember one time I was at a Panera chatting with somebody, and I heard somebody at another table answer this call. And she's like, hi, yeah. Oh, you know, I'm working at my second office location. And she said it dead serious. I was like, come on, man.
Hey, this make is a coffee shop. Make it till you make it.
Very much, man. So we got the LinkedIn. I almost said the Insta. We got Snapchat. So what's your name on Snapchat?
Okay, so story behind that is I actually made it at Podcast Movement, like right after I met you, because so many people were telling me to use Snapchat. Wow. And I didn't think I was going to use it. So my username is not Kwame.
What?
It's like my alias. Yeah, I'm probably going to need to change that to something more productive. Maybe like Kwame Negotiate, Deal Maker. I don't know, whatever. But right now it's not Kwame.
Yeah.
That's my username.
So I'm sure you'll do a snap if you do decide to change your name or set up a different account so people know where to actually go and find you from there. But hey, man, it's been great having you on the show. Dropped a lot of knowledge for people. And like I said, there's so many other things that we could talk about. And I'm sure there'll be listeners who have questions and want to be like, oh, so I'm dealing with this, I'm dealing with that, you know. And so we'll definitely have to have you back on again.
For sure, man. I'd love to.
Yeah. Talk a little bit more about it for the individual, but then also on the business side as well, you know, because Marcus and I, we've both, you know, been part of other projects where we have a team of individuals and we're talking shares and all of this other stuff. And there's even a lot of negotiation that can go on between friends who are starting something together. So, you know, we'll definitely have to talk about that in the future. But yeah, man, it's been an exquisite however long this recording has been.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. And don't forget to join the Paychecks and Balances email list by visiting paychecksandbalances.com/email. You'll receive the PMB weekly, where we cover top stories we found throughout the week, career and money management tips, and a lot more. Again, that link is paychecksandbalances.com/email. Of course, make sure you go over and check out Kwame's podcast and make sure that you rate the man in iTunes. He's dropping a lot of knowledge, a lot of stuff that's going to help people. Hopefully this episode has helped you. Wim/Marcus. One day the Marcus will be natural. I promise. But anything you want to add before we close this one out?
Nah, another great show.
Damn right, playa. So again, thanks to everyone for listening. Until next time, be safe. We out. Negotiate. Peace.